We're discussing Weikstra's response, his very good response, to William Rowe's evidential argument from evil. In our example that we're using, if you have half-wit parents who can barely put enough food on the table for the current day, it doesn't make much sense to think that there is some future good that the parents have in mind that they're intending by curtailing certain goods at the present time. But here's the rub. If you have an omniscient being, doesn't it make it much more likely that current allowings are in fact related to some future goods, and perhaps far future goods? It certainly seems to me eminently reasonable that this is the case. And so wise parents can curtail, and will curtail, the experience of goods now for goods in the far future. For example, Johnny may miss his dessert now, but the parents are putting aside that money for Johnny's college education, just as an example. So the idea is that as wisdom and intelligence in parents increase, so we can expect that current allowings, what the parent currently allows in Johnny's life, might have far in future benefits and goods for Johnny. So let's start to tie together some of these thoughts I've been saying with relation to Weikstra's article. Weikstra is saying at one point that in Rowe's original case, he was saying that it does not appear that the fawn suffering was necessary to bring about some greater good, or, in effect, Rowe is saying, was saying, that it appears that the fawn's suffering was pointless. What Weikstra goes on to show, then, is that when Rowe says that appear saying, when he makes that appear claim, he is in effect claiming that it appears that the fawn's suffering had no point. But notice the difference between sentences in which the appear and the no, the word no, the negative phrase, no. Notice the difference in senses between where the word appear and the word no occur within a sentence, okay? Take these two utterances. Think about what Rowe has said and compare these two. One, it does not appear that the fawn's suffering had a point. And compare it with this. Two, it appears that the fawn's suffering had no point. Okay, I think you can see that the second saying here is much stronger than the first. As Weikstra tried to establish in an earlier part of his essay, it seems that Rowe was saying that, in effect, when he made this claim about his fawn example, that he meant to say that the fawn suffering appears to have no point, that it appears not to have a point. And it seems that Rowe was not making the weaker claim, namely, that it does not appear to have a point. So at the heart of Weikstra's position is his formula, cornea. It has to do with seeing whether or not something, notice cornea and seeing. Cornea has to do with seeing whether or not something is the case or appears to be the case. So we were saying that making a claim like, one, it does not appear that it is going to rain today. Okay, suppose we make a claim like that. Based on the appearance of the weather at this point, rain seems improbable. If, on the other hand, we say, it appears that it is not going to rain today, you seem to be referring to some actual content in what you say, and those contents are reliable indicators that it is not going to rain. So in the first case, you are saying that it's not raining now, and some of the indicators that often point to rain are not present. But when you say, on the other hand, it appears that it is not going to rain today, it does seem that you are making a bit stronger claim. You are pointing to reliable indicators that, as one philosopher, Alvin Goldman, has said, track the truth. That when you have those sorts of indicators, for example, an absolutely clear sky and the weatherman's high-tech equipment telling us there is nothing on the front coming our way, then we may be allowed to make the stronger claim, it appears that it is not going to rain today. Take another example, and this is, I think, a very powerful one and easier to understand, and it should serve our purpose well. Say that a man is standing in front of us with a paper bag over his head, an opaque paper bag. We say of the man, with regard to whether or not we think the man has a mustache, we say this: it does not appear that the man has a mustache. After all, we cannot even see the poor guy's face in our example. We have no idea whether or not he has a mustache. And yet, if we make the claim, it appears that the man has no mustache, or it appears that the man doesn't have a mustache, that is a much stronger claim. We are not within our epistemic rights to say one way or the other. We cannot see his face, and so we are not within our rights to make this stronger appears claim, though perhaps we are permitted to make the first, weaker claim that it does not appear that the man has a mustache. But such a claim would not tell anything all that interesting. So if the man had no bag on his head, we could likely tell. But with an opaque object over his head, we are not entitled to say one way or the other. In a similar fashion, then, Weikstra makes the charge that Roe is making the stronger sort of appears claim. In effect, Weikstra is saying that there are elements in theism that argue against the rightness of Roe making that claim. So, in effect, Weikstra says that Roe's claim in regard to the fawn suffering and Sue's suffering is that it appears that there is no good reason that would justify God in allowing those sufferings. Weikstra says that, in fact, Roe is not justified in saying that. Now, why is that? Roe is not epistemologically committed to make the claim because packed into the very notion of theism is the very notion that God is omniscient. And not only so, but God is also creator of all that is. His vision and wisdom are therefore somewhat greater than ours. In fact, they far outstrip our abilities to understand goods and evils, to understand complex connections between goods and evils. I think it's very telling at this point to remember that William Roe, whose evidential argument we're trying to rebut, to answer, Roe himself is committed to the ethical outlook of intuitionism, especially that of G.E. Moore and his famous work Principia Ethica from 1903. It's clear from Roe's discussion that he's committed to Moore's ethical principles. And yet when we look at Moore, Moore himself claims that evils and goods mix in such complex ways that we're likely not to understand and see the connections thereof. And so on the second to last page of Principia Ethica, Moore says the following. He's talking about the main object of this particular chapter entitled The Ideal, the last chapter, chapter 6 of his work, The Principles of Ethics, Principia Ethica. And he says that one of the purposes of this chapter is this, particularly to point out that there is a vast variety of great intrinsic goods and great intrinsic evils, and that the simplest of them are, with one exception, highly complex wholes composed of parts which have little or no value in themselves. Now, I find this to be very interesting, and I offer this as a technique to defeat the opponent in an apologetic discussion or argument. And that is that your opponent, if they claim allegiance to a certain school, then they must claim allegiance to the whole of that school. If Roe claims allegiance to Moore's ethics, then he should claim allegiance to everything that Moore says about ethics. Moore has said that occurrences of evils and goods, complex and intricate, are that very way. They are complex in their very nature, that they mix together in ways that we cannot understand always. And so it seems to me that Roe has to take this into account. The very ethical theorist that he adopts, Moore himself says that evils and goods mix in very complex ways. Then when you throw in Weikstra's idea, saying and urging us to remember that God is omniscient, as well as Draper's idea that the goods we know of are not a representative sample of all the goods that there are, it seems very dubious that Roe is within his right to claim that, therefore, there are instances of evil which God should have prevented if he existed. When we talk about the outweighing goods that God has in mind if he exists and allows a certain suffering, it's got to be a good that's purposed by the creator of all that is. When we think of the intricate systems of nature and all the interconnectedness of things, it would be quite unlikely that we could see the good involved with God's allowing that suffering, so Weikstra claims. So if we apply Crania to this situation, as Weikstra does, he claims that a person on the basis of the way things on the basis of the way a person takes things to be, a person is entitled to claim that it appears that there is no good for God to allow that suffering, only if it is reasonable for that person to believe that, given her cognitive faculties and the use she has made of them, if there were a good that would justify God in allowing the fawn or Sue, this person would see the situation, it is likely, to be different than it is, in some way discernible by her. Okay? That's what Crania applied is doing in Weikstra's theodicy. So the person is entitled, in effect, to make the claim that the fawn's suffering is for no good reason, or the fawn's suffering appears to be for no good reason, only if it were the case that if there were some good reason for the fawn to suffer in that way, then that person would likely see that difference, would see some sort of discernible difference. They would, that is, be able to see a trace of the good and see the justification, the interconnectedness of good and evil, justifying God in allowing the fawn or Sue to suffer. But Weikstra says, based on theism alone and the sort of being theism proposes for belief, that that's just incredible to believe. As the connectedness of things, good and evils, becomes more complex, that outstrips our intellectual abilities, but it doesn't outstrip God's because he's omniscient. And so this is where Bayes' theorem comes in. Whenever a theorem predicts state C to come about, and then state C does come about, the skeptic cannot say, "Look, state C, your theory is thus disproved." For, after all, my theory predicted that C would come about. How, therefore, could C show that my theory is disconfirmed? What Weikstra is saying is that theism, given the limited ability of our cognitive status, given that we don't know all the goods that there are, theism predicts that we will not always be able to see the interconnectedness of things, goods and evils. But God being omniscient, theism predicts that God may have a good reason for the interconnectedness to be complex. Because after all, he's omniscient, and he has a purpose as the creator of all that is, bringing it to a good end, even if that end is not immediately present and known by the finite individual human knower. And so think of what Rowe said when he asked the question, if God exists, why would he hide his reasons from us? Say, for example, you had a visitor, and the visitor was an expert in foreign languages, all languages. Suppose that after the visitor left, he had inadvertently forgot some papers on the desk that he was borrowing while he was at your place. And you see the papers, you look at them, and none of the symbols make sense to you. It's just gobbledygook to you. Suppose that you say, after looking at the paper, it appears to me that this is gobbledygook, that there's nothing rational being transmitted in these symbols. But in that case, the professor does know what those symbols mean. It's very rational to believe that professor of foreign languages does in fact know what the symbols on the to you incomprehensible sheet in fact mean. The professor would not be intending, by having that sheet, the professor would not be intending to trick you or to make you think that there's no reason. It's just that because of the disparity of the level of understanding that foreign language between you and the professor, there's just no way for us to say anything besides, I don't know, that this paper is transmitting something cognitively meaningful. But we're certainly not within our rights to say, it appears to me that this paper does not transmit a cognitively meaningful message. It's certainly not within our rights to say that. Although Weikstra does not refer to Bayes' theorem explicitly in the article referred to earlier, you can see this very thing at work if you check out that article. Near the end of the article, in section 4, toward the end of the second full paragraph. Now, a number of theistic philosophers, including myself, they are persuaded that Weikstra's principle, cornea, or something very near to it, is acceptable, telling, and true. So, we tend to give credence to Weikstra's article. William Alston, for example, now semi-retired professor, formerly at Syracuse University, agrees with Weikstra. He says that the reason why we are not privy to the interconnectedness of things is that we are missing crucial data. What are these crucial data? Well, Alston lays them out to be the following 8 things. 1, we are missing crucial data in these areas. 1, whether there is an afterlife and what that afterlife is like. 2, the secrets of the human heart. We're missing these crucial data. The secrets of the human heart, particularly the attitudes, intentions, and motives, and so forth, of human beings. Other crucial data missing is 3, we don't have a full record of human behavior. We don't know anyone else's behavior, whether public or private. 4, we don't know whether there are free creatures besides human beings. We don't have, that is, philosophical evidence for such. Scripture, of course, tells us that they exist, but we do not have philosophical evidence for example, the existence of the devil. Some evidence, perhaps, yes, but not absolutely compelling evidence, one might argue. 5, we don't know the range of human debauchery, wickedness in the past, present, and future. Since there are future goods, the evils allowed today may well be allowed because of the coming about of future goods, and thus we wouldn't understand those things. They're not even present to us. They don't even exist yet. 6, we don't know the total consequences of any particular seemingly gratuitous and terrible evil. Those things outstrip our abilities. 7, our cognitive abilities are limited in relevant respects, especially our capacity to figure out what is necessary and what is possible for certain other things to come about. We don't always see that some evil was absolutely necessary to gain some good. Oftentimes, we're just not sure. And 8, our abilities to grasp big complexes of things, those organic wholes I spoke of earlier, like whole natural organic systems and possible worlds, the way the world might have been. Our capacities to grasp those things are in fact woefully inadequate. Hence, our ability to make evaluative comparisons between those sorts of things, say between the value of one possible world and another, is likely to be faulty, or if not faulty, at least suspect. Now, with these 8 points, Alston goes in some ways beyond the point where Weikstra stops. Weikstra is merely saying that since God is omniscient and we are not, we cannot always be within our rights to say that certain things appear a certain way and to be justified in saying that they really are that way. Because God knows of such great interconnections, goods and evils, and the connections thereof in ways that we do not. But Alston goes a little bit further, and he borders on the not esteemed position of moral skepticism. Moral skepticism. This is not an enviable position, because then any of our judgments will be found to be suspect, and we certainly don't want that. From what we said earlier, I think we know when something is evil, we know when a good something is occurring, and yet we may not be justified in saying certain appears claims about goods and evils because of the connections thereof. There might be a present evil that is only justified by the occurrence or possible occurrence of a future good. If the future good is only possibly going to come about, it may not come about. And its not coming about was in fact necessary. At least if the possibility of something coming about was the intended target of allowing a present evil, then that thing still may not come about because it was only a possibility. If it comes about and we see the good, we may say, ah, that was gracious of God to allow that evil because this future good came about. But what if a person doesn't make the sort of right response? We would be left in a situation in which we would not say, because the good never came about, we could not say, ah, there's the good that justified God in allowing that evil. But it falls upon the shoulders of rational, free, moral agents to make the right sorts of decisions. If they don't, then those goods that God allowed present evils for might not come about. And therefore, there'd be no clear indication to us to signal, ah, God was justified in allowing that past evil. So at any rate, what we need to see from this is to beware of anything that approaches moral skepticism, because we do want to say that God is good. We do want to say that cramming one's toe into the wall inadvertently is evil because it causes suffering and misery. And we do want to say that good work leading to a job promotion is an intrinsic good. It's a person benefiting good, and we want to say that. We don't want to say, well, I don't know if it's good or not. It is good, and we know those things, and so we have to avoid moral skepticism. However, Alston's 8 points are helpful because he has pointed out many things that are outside, they are data that are crucial to making appears claims about evils, but they are data that are outside our cognitive ability. So, good job, Professor Alston, with respect to what you've pointed out. The last question we need to ask with respect to cornea is, why accept cornea? After all, at the end of cornea, we have an odd subjunctive phrase, don't we? When he says, Weikstra, if P were not the case, S would likely be different than it is in some way discernible by her. That's part and parcel of the end of cornea, Weikstra's epistemic access condition. So it may be that some people are just not able to make sense of conditionals like that. If I cognize a certain thing, I may not understand ways that that thing might have been different than it actually is. So maybe Weikstra's case is weakened by this criticism, which some scholars have leveled against Weikstra. In other words, some scholars have leveled a criticism that some people can be in their proper rights to make an appearance claim that P appears to be the case, even though they do not have the ability to see that if things were different, they would be most likely to see something that's different. Young children, for example, or people of very low intelligence can see that something appears to be the case. For example, they're sitting in warm water, but they may not be able to make the relevant subjunctive judgments, like if the water were different than it is. But that confuses a basic distinction. This criticism possible of Weikstra confuses a basic distinction in epistemology. After all, it's one thing to be justified in believing that P, but it's quite another thing to show that you are justified in believing that P. So, Weikstra's principle is okay. Even though a person can't show that even though P were the case, S would likely be different, and so forth. S, the cognized situation. They could still be entitled to use cornea, young children, people of low intelligence, and so forth, and it would be acceptable to use cornea for those people. I conclude that Weikstra has made a good argument and that cornea is acceptable. This is the end of 10.